Now in session, Judge Larkin, Judge Larson, Judge Bentley, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Let's be seated. Thank you. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals 5. We have three oral hearings this morning. Judge Bentley is unable to be present, but she will listen to the oral arguments and participate in the case after the hearing this morning. The first case on the calendar is State v. Could you pronounce it for me? Waman, State v. Waman. Each side will have 15 minutes for their primary argument, and appellate counsel will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Recording is being made of this hearing, which will be available to the public, an audio recording. No additional recordings are permitted. Each attorney should be sure to clearly state his or her name for the record before each leg of the argument so we know who's speaking on that recording. With that, we're ready to hear from counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Honor. Good morning. I'm Maggie Samick, S-A-M-E-C, appearing for the appellant, Mr. Waman.
Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case is about a stipulated evidence bench trial consisting of 28 exhibits. It is a fact-intensive case. There's only one piece, though, of direct evidence, and that was a statement by student M.M. made after a 5-year delay. She alleged that in fifth grade, her Spanish teacher, Mr. Waman, in a room full of students that also had a teaching assistant in it, touched her chest. There is insufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Waman intentionally and with sexual intent touched M.M.'s breast. The appellant's conviction of criminal sexual conduct fifth degree can rest on the uncorroborated testimony of a single credible witness, but M.M. is not credible. She also...
Why is she not credible?
Her parents and school, as you may have noticed in the brief, it was very extensive, have identified lying behaviors specifically. And when she was at the facility in October of 2022, just 2 months before she made this 5-year delayed report in December, she was asked upon admittance if there was a history of physical or sexual abuse, to which she said no. While she was at that facility, the parents were interviewed about their concerns for their child. They specifically made note of their concern about increased lying, number one. And then number two, her father stated that he wanted M.M. to feel like she doesn't need to make up stories and different narratives about things and absorb other people's narratives.
Let me ask you this. Were all of these arguments presented to the district court?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the district court nonetheless found her credible and provided an explanation as to why?
Correct.
On what basis would we set aside that credibility determination to which we are required to defer?
Thank you, Your Honor. It would be unusual, I will give you that. This is an unusual case, though. When I searched Westlaw high and low, I found no cases similar to this one. It's very unique in that it was a paper trial, and there was no testimony. There were out-of-court statements by both.
But your client agreed to that procedure. He agreed that it would be a paper trial. And with that agreement comes an implicit agreement that the judge is going to have to resolve conflicting testimony and make credibility determinations. So I don't know that you can say, well, this is a paper trial, therefore you should ignore the judge's determination. The judge had to make the determination based on the record that the parties agreed to.
That's true. One thing she did make as a finding of fact, though, related to her opinion, there was no expert testimony about whether teenagers are more or less truthful or not truthful. That was concerning in the findings of fact, Your Honor.
I have a slightly different question. I mean, It seems to me that you're making an argument regarding the intent element, and then we're talking about direct evidence. But usually isn't intent proved by circumstantial evidence?
Yes. So this is a unique case because of it being on paper. And I think that looking at the elements of the crime, if those elements are satisfied, except for it's time to look at intent, then you have to look at it through circumstantial evidence, because there's no other way to do it unless, you know, we have a case where somebody says ahead of time, I'm going to kill you, and then they do it, or something where they indicate intent before doing a crime.
And was it argued to the district court that even if this touching happened, your client didn't mean to, or was intent always argued based sort of on the credibility of this, that the event either happened or it didn't? What is our record before the district court with regard to that?
That is a good question. I did not argue it before the district court. Okay. One moment.
Well, please. I'm going to follow up on that.
Sure.
At trial, paper trial, the defense was he never touched her breasts. If he touched her, it was her hair, her shoulder, her arm. He did not touch her breast. You need the touching of the breast to get the crim sex conviction. I did not see any argument below or in the brief that if he touched her, it was without sexual intent, and here's the circumstantial evidence analysis that gets you there. So, you know, my concern is like, yes, circumstantial evidence would apply, and the standard would apply if his argument was, oh, I may have touched her breast, it was accidental, it wasn't without sexual intent. But I don't see that argument anywhere in the briefs or represented in the court proceedings below, so I don't know that we need to go to circumstantial evidence. In sum, if the defense theory has been and is he never touched her breast, we don't even get to his intent.
I see your point. I still think a finding of fact needs to be made, though, about the intent, right? Because that's one of the elements.
Right, but did the district court not make that finding?
They did.
Okay. So we've got a finding by the district court based on the district court's consideration of the record the parties stipulated to, and the district court made a finding that he touched her breast, and he did so with sexual intent based on all of the circumstances. It's appellant's burden on appeal in order to get relief to come in here and say, well, our theory is he touched her breast, but it wasn't intentional, and here's our alternative hypothesis of innocence based on the circumstances proved. So what is that argument? I didn't see that in your brief.
Well, Your Honor, it sounds like you're saying it's foreclosed because it wasn't argued previously.
Well, I guess I'm struggling with how you come up and say we need to apply the circumstantial evidence standard of review, which relates only to his intent, when he never challenged his intent. He simply said, I didn't touch her breast.
I don't know. When I was reviewing case law, I don't remember reading anything that supports what you just said in terms of.
Okay, let me ask you this. Where is your circumstantial evidence analysis in the briefing? I mean, where is it that you set out, okay, apply circumstantial evidence, it goes to intent, here are the circumstances proved, which are determined by viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict and rejecting any evidence that conflicts with the verdict. And given those circumstances, here's a reasonable hypothesis of innocence which finds support in the record. Where in your brief do we walk through that?
Thank you, Your Honor. The brief was focused on the facts and focused on them not being substantial enough.
Well, then, if application of the circumstantial evidence standard is foreclosed, it's foreclosed first and foremost for inadequate briefing. You haven't given us the argument that enables us to do that analysis. At least I'm not seeing it. It seems like the entire brief is the district court erred by finding this complaining witness credible.
That is the strongest argument, Your Honor. I mean, and you're right. Everything that I put in the brief the court also saw. But the issue is the district court relied so heavily on the 404B evidence of SD's statement.
Again, did you agree that evidence could be submitted at the paper trial?
Yes.
With any qualifications, with any challenge? Were there parameters regarding what it would be, its consideration at trial?
It had been argued ahead of time, and I don't think the judge in her findings of fact delved into that information. But the issue with that 404B evidence, Your Honor, is that it wasn't a crime. There wasn't a crime committed. And the judge seemed to focus on the fact that they were both students in fifth grade, that they're at the same school.
Okay, so the judge, there was an objection to the admission of 404B evidence. The judge made a ruling. In your brief, do you walk through the analysis of why that ruling was erroneous? I don't recall seeing that.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that it was erroneous to be considered 404B. I'm just saying the application of it, saying that it's so similar to corroborate the allegation. That's the issue that I see, Your Honor.
Okay, and that is an error because why?
Because it is, some of the facts are certainly similar. They're both kids, they're both in fifth grade, they're both at the same school, had the same teacher. The difference is there was no crime committed, nothing alleged as to SD.
But it doesn't, it's 404B involves evidence of prior bad acts. It does not have to be a criminal conviction to qualify as 404B evidence.
I understand that, Your Honor. The concern is that the court relied so heavily on SD's allegations to say that's enough to corroborate MM's allegations. But when you look at the entire record and you look at that this child had put forth three potential witnesses, saying one was an eyewitness, and she's like, no, I didn't see it. One was her father, and she admitted he doesn't remember it. The other was a friend who's like, I never heard that.
But there was also someone who said, yeah, some of us thought he was creepy and he was touching this other girl in a way that made us uncomfortable.
Right.
So and doesn't that tend to corroborate MM's accusation, even though corroboration's not necessary?
Right. Well, AW is the one who said, she didn't tell me that, but I heard that SD, who was my former classmate, said something about touching her hair and saying she was beautiful or something like that. What's interesting about that, Your Honor, is if MM had in fact told AW, look, he did this inappropriate stuff to me, AW is going to not remember that, but she's going to remember that he touched my hair and said I'm pretty. That doesn't make any sense. It also doesn't make sense that a father would not remember his own daughter saying a teacher was inappropriate with me. This is so important in terms of her credibility, and I feel like that 404B evidence overshadowed looking at all of the, like, the background, the information related to MM herself.
Are you aware of any case in which this court has reversed CRIMSAC's based on a finding that the victim was not credible? I'm aware of the Minnesota Supreme Court cases you've cited. They are pretty distinguishable from this case. Are you aware of, first of all, in any case where this court has done that?
I did not find any.
Does not have sort of the broad ability to grant relief where we think justice might require it. I'm just wondering, where is our authority to say
this is a stepping stone if it wants to go further?
Understood.
Yeah.
Additional questions? Additional argument? You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal to address the state's argument.
Well, I would also just point out, Your Honor, that in looking at MM's claim, there was nothing whatsoever to support it. I already went through the three witnesses that she proffered, but also there was no excited utterances ever. There wasn't a 911 call. There's no recorded recollection. There was no medical report. There was nothing to support this. And in fact, medical records supported that nothing happened when she told them 2 months ahead of this 5-year delayed report that she did not have a history of physical or sexual abuse. So there's a lot of concern on our part that this child is not credible. And it does, because her dad was so concerned that she would make up stories and absorb other people's narratives, that certainly she could have just grabbed onto something she remembered from fifth grade when she was in trouble with her mother in December of 2022 and taken that story and expounded upon it. That would fit with what this child's problems have been as terms of what we see in the record.
Understood.
Yeah.
Understood.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now hear from the state. Is it my understanding that we have a student attorney arguing for the state this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what is your name for the record?
My name is Evan Coakley. That's C-O-A-K-L-E-Y. Appearing under the student practice rule with me in the room is my supervising attorney, Robert Yant.
You may proceed with your argument. If you need to adjust the podium, there is a button that allows you to do that. Many people need to adjust it. Thank you. I can see you better now. Thank you.
Great.
You may proceed.
In 2017, a fifth grade girl was sexually abused at her school by her teacher. This girl, referred to as MM, disclosed the abuse in 2022 and identified the appellant as her teacher. After a bench trial and stipulated evidence, the district court found appellant guilty of fifth-degree criminal sexual conduct for abusing MM. But now, appellant challenges his conviction and claims that the evidence was insufficient to support the guilty verdict. Appellant is incorrect in this. He invites the court to blur the distinct roles of reviewing courts and finders of fact, and instead seeks to relitigate credibility determinations as he sees fit. This court should reject that invitation and affirm the judgment of the district court. I'd like to address a few topics today, then. First, why this court should apply the traditional standard of review. Second, how the evidence supports appellant's conviction. And finally, how the evidence would be sufficient even under the standard of review that appellant proposes. I'd like to turn now to that proper standard of review. Appellant seeks to apply the circumstantial evidence standard of review to a conviction for which there is direct evidence. The determining factor in which standard of review to apply is not the presence of circumstantial evidence, but rather the presence of direct evidence.
Well, the direct evidence would go to whether or not the touching occurred, correct? I mean, you don't disagree that there is an element that requires circumstantial evidence. This isn't a case where the defendant said, admitted to doing this, or admitted that that was the purpose of the incident.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the element that's really being disputed here that all of the briefing is talking about is the actual touching itself, and that is proven by direct evidence.
Is it also your recollection of the record that there was never an argument made below that if there was a touching, then the defendant, it was without intent? Is that also your recollection of the record?
Yes, Your Honor. I've reviewed it multiple times. I haven't been able to find anything that really laid that out in the argument in the record below or in the briefing in this case.
Thank you.
And we can even see that the Minnesota Supreme Court has applied this type of analysis as recently as 2024 in State v. Jones, where the direct evidence standard applied because there was direct evidence supporting the conviction, even though there was an element there for which there was only circumstantial evidence.
What's the citation for Jones, please?
One moment, Your Honor.
I see it here.
Okay.
Thank you.
And here, the state presented direct evidence of appellant's crime in the form of statements from his victim. The presence of additional circumstantial evidence to support that does not make his conviction then subject to a heightened scrutiny. If this court was to accept appellant's reasoning that the circumstantial evidence standard must apply across the board to all elements, just because there is an intent element for which there is no direct evidence, then nearly every criminal conviction would be subject to the circumstantial evidence standard on all elements.
So here's my question. So even applying direct evidence, you know, is there a hypothetical case where a district court makes credibility determinations that are just wildly against the weight of the evidence? So let's not take this case. Let's take a case where, the victim said one thing, but then we have evidence that the victim was actually in a totally different location at the time she's alleging the offense occurred. And the district court says, no, I still find the victim credible because of all of these other things, even though, you know, there's evidence in the record that the victim was not actually even in the physical location that they're alleging. In that circumstance, under the direct evidence test, could we reverse? I guess I'm trying to tease out sort of what is the scope of our review on direct evidence when there is sort of the tension in the credibility of the witness, especially in a paper trial where, you know, the district court isn't really reading the expressions of the person on the stand, which are often the reasons why we defer to the district court.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes. It's conceivable that there could be a situation in which, the interests of justice would require that sort of break with the record below. However, that's not the case that we have here. The evidence heavily supports the verdict here, this even is distinguishable from a lot of other bench trials in that we do actually have recordings of the statements of the victim in which the district court's able to assess to make those credibility determinations as well. Moving on with that direct evidence standard of review in mind, it's time to discuss the evidence presented in this case. As a reminder, under this standard, the question is not whether the fact finder could have reasonably found appellant innocent, just whether they could have reasonably found appellant guilty. Appellant noted, it is possible for the conviction to rest on the uncorroborated testimony of a single credible witness. The state's case had that and more. This conviction rests on the statements of the victim, but also on corroborating and circumstantial evidence that supports that. MM's credible statements as the victim of the crime constituted direct evidence of appellant's crime. MM recounted specific details of abuse that happened over the course of the 2017 to 2018 school year. MM recounted how she was a student in appellant's fifth grade classroom that year. Appellant seated her in the back of the classroom, telling her it was so they could have more private conversations. This isolated her so that typically no other students would be looking her way. Appellant started to call her pet names like Angel and Hermosa. He started to touch her. He would make sure that no one was looking by handing out assignments from the front of the classroom to the back, ending on her so he could linger near her. He would play with her hair. He started to rub her back while she tried to work on her assignments. This happened while she was in appellant's classroom for months. After about 3 months of this, appellant started to reach his hands down during this time to rub MM's waist and up to her breasts. He would squeeze her breasts. And MM even demonstrated the forceful nature of the squeezing during her corner house interview. I would like to direct the court's attention to about the 25-minute, 44-second mark for that. The forceful nature of his physical contact eliminates any sort of notion that it was not intentional or sexual in nature. Now, when MM would reject his advances, he'd get pouty and say things like, "Oh, please, Angel." If she tried to get the attention of classmates, he'd quickly move away and pretend like nothing had happened. This continued throughout the school year until appellant left MM's school near the end of the year. Now, this statement alone would be sufficient to convict appellant, but that's not all that supported his conviction. There were also statements from another student, referred to as SD, offered to show intent, common scheme, absence of mistake, and modus operandi. There was a lot of talk about this evidence before. I would like to note that the 404B admissibility was argued below. There is an order finding that admissible on March 18th of 2024. As well as, of course, stipulated as admissible.
But I don't think that, I don't understand the appellant's argument to be that the 404B ruling was improper so much as the weight that the district court gave it in making its determinations on elements like whether the incident occurred and what the defendant's intent was, that they gave that too much weight because there are distinguishing factors between those incidents, which I think you would acknowledge. Why isn't appellant right about that?
Thank you, Your Honor. The decision of how much weight to give testimony on different aspects, that's entirely for the district court, and this court just has to give deference to that. It was used properly below to show that intent and absence of mistake. That's exactly what it was used for. And of course, it's also lends itself to that credibility that SD was not in the same class as MM, did not know MM, and yet still could corroborate specific details of appellant's methods.
Counsel, did you do any research into whether our deferential credibility standard differs in the context of a paper trial versus live witness testimony?
I do not believe it does differ, Your Honor.
Okay. No. Did you do any research to support that belief?
Yes, Your Honor, very briefly. I do have...
So did you find anything that sheds light on this question of whether, you know, we should give less deference if it's a paper trial versus a traditional trial with live witness testimony?
There is State v. Cox, Your Honor, that's 278 Northwest 2D.
Hold on. So 62. 278, 62? And yep. What does Cox say about the issue?
I'd have to pull up for more information about it, but I do know that it stands for the proposition that the sufficiency of the evidence standard applies the same to bench and jury trials.
Bench and jury, but nothing more specific in terms of the credibility determination and the deference we give to the credibility determination if it's affidavit testimony versus live testimony.
Nothing specifically,
that I don't you know found. Specific,
but I would okay. be happy to submit a supplemental.
I'm not aware of anything.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if you've found anything else. I didn't find anything that suggests in the criminal context it's any different.
Thank you, Your Honor. To move on to some of the evidence that SD was able to present, SD offered statements that appellant would single her out at his desk for private talks. There he would touch her on her thighs. Other times, appellant would approach SD at her desk. While other students weren't looking, he would offer her massages and get pouty when she refused. He didn't stop at her shoulders either. He would then reach down her back into her stomach, much like with MM. This is highly corroborative of the manner in which appellant singled out his female students to grope them. Now, the stipulated evidence also included some of MM's school records, which corroborated details from her statement, like when in the school year she started to go to appellant's classroom and at what time of the day every day that occurred. The evidence also included some of her medical records, which showed a downturn in MM's mental health in middle school that tends to support a recent history of abuse. Now, there is ample direct and circumstantial evidence to support appellant's conviction. However, moving on to the final part of my analysis here, under either the traditional standard or the circumstantial standard of review, the evidence here is more than sufficient to support appellant's conviction. Both standards start at the same point, identifying the circumstances proved in a light most favorable to the verdict. In this case, the record shows that appellant touched M.M.'s breasts repeatedly while in his fifth grade classroom in the 2017 to 2018 school year, and his contemporaneous contact with S.D. shows it was neither an accident nor an unplanned mistake. From there, the reviewing court considers...
I mean, under the circumstantial evidence test, why couldn't we say that S.D.'s testimony that he engaged in similar behaviors but never did, in fact, touch her breast shows that that was not the intent of this touching? It might have been a bad act, but there wasn't, there wasn't this sort of sexual intent. And that, in fact, that other statement might weigh the other way. Because if we're applying the circumstantial evidence test, then it's our responsibility to say whether there's any reasonable inference from the evidence that would say that it wasn't his intent to touch her breasts.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, the evidence from SD tends to support that this was planned and premeditated in some way, or just rather, yeah, it shows that intent in that way. We still have the statements from MM that are direct evidence
They're direct evidence that the conduct occurred. They're not direct evidence of appellant's intent. And I do think once we get into the circumstantial evidence test, if we're talking about intent in particular, then we're looking at what our reasonable inference is, right?
Yes, Your Honor. However, with the circumstances proved, if the touching occurred, especially in the nature that MM described, there really is no other reasonable inference for grabbing and squeezing a fifth grade student's breasts other than sexual intent.
Thank you, counsel. I think that is a good place to end, and we're going to have counsel for appellant pick up right where you left off. Counsel, could you tell the court, given the facts proved, what is your reasonable hypothesis of innocence and what evidence in the record supports it?
Sure. Well, it's funny that Judge Larson asked that question towards the end. We believe that SD's statement, that 404B statement, where she described inappropriate conduct, a prior bad act, but it was not sexual in nature. There was no sexual contact. So our view is that if there was any touch by Mr. Wahman, that it was inadvertent.
Okay, so your argument is if he touched her breast, it was inadvertent.
Correct.
And the evidence in the record that supports that theory is?
The statement of SD, which has been so heavily relied upon, and
that although he was touching SD in a similar way, he didn't touch her breast.
Right.
Shows that he didn't touch the complaining witness's breast.
One would think that if somebody had the intent to do that to children, right, that there would be, that he would have done that to SD. There have been there's nothing in the records here, Your Honor, that there was ever a complaint made to the school. He'd been a teacher for quite a while. The teaching assistant was in the room all the
time.
His
statement, did he give a statement to the police? Yes.
He gave a written statement, I believe, that was put in as an affidavit.
And that was put in as an affidavit.
Yes.
And in his statement, did he at any point say, and if I did touch her breast, it was accidental, I didn't mean to do it, or was the statement unequivocal, I'd never touched her breast?
What I recall about the statement was that he would touch, I believe he said he would touch a child in relation to, like, teaching or in a supportive manner, something.
So essentially he denied that he touched her breast.
Correct. So
what do we do with the fact that we have essentially, not defendant's testimony, but defendant's affidavit put forth by the court in lieu of his testimony? By finding him guilty, the district court rejected his testimony. So how can he now say, well, a circumstance proved is I accidentally touched her breast, evidence he put in was I never touched any child in an inappropriate manner, which would rule out the touching of the breast?
Sure. It's a rational hypothesis, Your Honor. So if he believes he never touched her breast and she's saying, no, you did, well,
okay,
obviously it had to have been a mistake or inadvertent if he in fact did.
Understood.
I would just like to, I don't know if you want to hear this, but I was a little disturbed by the implication that this child's mental health issues stemmed from fifth grade. It's in the record. I'm not going to belabor it, but stuff started earlier than that. The mother said, like, between 8 and 10, she started becoming fascinated with knives. She was keeping knives in her bedroom. She got kicked out of Hebrew school in the summertime for bringing a knife there and making inappropriate comments about knives. So this child was having issues earlier on in her life, and she continued and continues to have issues. And it's in the record that there's issues with the family.
Counsel, that is inappropriate. How are her family's issues relevant to the determination before the court, and why is that type of information not respected as non-private information?
Okay.
Was any of that information presented at trial?
Yes. It's in the record, Your Honor.
Information regarding her family's
issues? Yes, it's in the record.
Okay.
The reason I'm bringing it up is counsel is trying to blame the fifth grade teacher for all the issues that this child has had. And I'm just trying to rebut that.
What was the record evidence regarding her family's issues?
Sure. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm just flipping through trying to find the citation for you. Exhibit 7 talks about the knives, and then Exhibit 7 also talks about the family history of mental health issues in the family. I don't have anything further.
Okay. Do you want to take a moment to summarize? You can do that.
Oh, well, thank you, Your Honor. So in a nutshell, Your Honor, we believe that the evidence is not sufficient and that the court relied on that 404B evidence without giving due weight to the fact that that child, SD, never said that a crime occurred against her. And also that SD's statement itself does support a finding that if Mr. Wahman did touch MM, that it was inadvertent because he doesn't believe he did it, and SD doesn't say that he did it to him. Thank you.
Thank you. Just taking a note. Thank you. All right. We appreciate the arguments in the briefing, and the matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. Thank you for your participation in the hearing.